Hello and welcome to the Counting the Earth podcast from the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. I'm Sue Nelson.
And I'm Alice Hope. Throughout this podcast, we explore the environment and the natural world, always through the lens of one number.
And today's number is 450, as in 450 square kilometres of natural salt marsh remaining in the UK.
Because this time we're taking a look at those wonderful intertidal habitats that can be found around our coastline, such as in the Thames, Severn, Humber and Firth estuaries.
And as you'll hear shortly, I visited one of the UK's newer salt marshes, WWT Steert Marshes in Somerset, to discover the huge benefits of these coastal ecosystems.
We'll also be speaking to Annette Burden from UKCEH about how salt marshes might help mitigate climate change.
But first, let's get down to some basics. Help me out here, Alice. 450 square kilometres. I'm struggling to visualise that, and I suspect I'm not the only one. Now, in the last episode on earthworms and soil health, you rather helpfully converted 50 trillion, as in 50 trillion UK earthworms, to its equivalent mass in elephants, because, well, why not? Do you have another way of measuring 450 square kilometres of salt marsh that will give me and anyone listening a better idea of what that looks like in terms of size?
Nothing as fun as units of elephants, I'm afraid, but does this help? It is about the same size as the Isle of Arran off the west coast of Scotland, which is 432 square kilometres.
It doesn't help me at all, actually, because I've never been there. Have you got any football pitch comparisons? Because, well, it's used quite commonly, isn't it, football pitches? And I know it was used when the International Space Station was first constructed.
Yeah, it is a lot more than the space station. It's about equivalent to 64,286 British football pitches. So actually, that's probably no easier to imagine than the original number.
No, it's not. And that makes it sound like a large area of salt marshes. But given that we're an island nation and the length of the coastline around mainland Britain is nearly 18,000 kilometres, a mere 450 square kilometres is actually then a surprisingly small area.
Yes, it really is, and it is a lot less than we used to have. In England alone, we've lost around 85% of our salt marshes over the last 150 years, either drained and reclaimed for agriculture, development, or for coastal flood defences, or they were degraded through pollution, lost to erosion and rising sea levels. The list goes on, really. And globally, there has been widespread degradation and loss of salt marshes due to human activity. And if we don't act to halt this decline, we could lose up to a tenth of the remaining habitat by 2060.
And when we say salt marsh, we aren't talking about all river outlets into the sea, are we?
No, these areas are part land, part water. Salt marshes are coastal ecosystems that are periodically flooded and drained by the sea when the tide goes in and out. They're boggy, marshy places found along shelter parts of the coastline. This is the world of Dickens' Great Expectations, but it's not all dull mudflats. You get a lot of plant life making up an ever-changing mosaic landscape of blue and green. In the tropics, you might get mangrove swamps instead.
Well, as we're going to discover, salt marshes have a lot to offer, including helping to tackle climate change. And a term we'll hear mentioned a few times is blue carbon. What's blue carbon?
Part of the push to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions involves utilising the natural world around us. And on a previous episode of this podcast, we have looked at the contribution that land-based solutions such as growing trees can make, so-called green carbon. So blue carbon refers to the carbon captured and stored by the oceans and coastal ecosystems like salt marshes, and we are going to hear more about that on this episode.
The most visible benefit of these landscapes is, of course, their huge importance as a habitat for migratory birds and other wildlife, which I saw firsthand when I visited one of the largest reclaimed salt marshes in the UK. WWT, that's the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust, that's what the WWT stands for, Steert Marshes in Somerset, and I got a personal tour from site manager Alice Laver.
We're currently driving through sort of the middle of the Wetland Walkway and Otterhampton Marshes, which is a really nice example of the sort of mosaic of wetland habitats that Steeart Marshes has. So we have the freshwater areas, and then we've got a brackish area, and then the salt marshes a little bit further ahead.
It's a bit rough on the old back, this, isn't it?
It is indeed. That's why we call it the access track. So it's strictly for work vehicles, and the visitors get a nice surface foot path.
And it's funny, you can automatically sort of see the difference there on the left and the right, to us, you've got more bulrushes, grasses on the right, and then more like traditional hedgerows and blackthorn on the left.
Absolutely, and a lot of those traditional hedgerows that you can see were planted up as part of the original scheme, sort of the project.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to getting out and getting down and dirty, so to speak, because there will be some mud, won't there?
There's going to be plenty of mud, yeah, lots of mud around.
I can't help noticing that as we're sort of driving along this bumpy access road, all these flies sort of in front of the car windscreen.
That's a brilliant thing with wetlands, is the amount of invertebrate life it supports, and then in turn all the birds as they come in, especially the hirundines, they'll be moving in shortly, so it's a fantastic food source. And bats, of course, as well. We have 11 different species of bats at Steeart Marshes that use every part of the site, including the salt marsh. Just pulling up to Quantock Hide now, and this is one of our favourite hides at this time of year, because we've just started to get the avocets and the little ring plover and the oyster catchers are all starting to prospect and start setting up their territories for nesting.
I'm just excited it's not raining, to be honest.
Do you know what? Yeah, I'll take that.
Oh, listen to that underfoot, nice and squelchy. I love it, that squelch, squelch, squelch. So great.
Right, so we're just approaching, this is one of the saline lagoons in front of the Quantock Hide. So you can see here we've still got some of the wintering widgeon that have been, that sort of holding on. They'll be
now, widgeon. I'm used to sparrows, maybe the very occasionally a goldfinch, blue tits, widgeons. Is that a duck?
It is a duck, yes, absolutely. And they've got this most amazing sort of bright sort of Mohican, and they are your classic sort of wetland duck noise. They've got this amazing whistle, and we get thousands of them sort of grazing on the salt marsh grasses. What you can hear at the moment, though, that's the avocets. So they are probably one of the loudest waders that we have breeding at Steeart Marshes. Really, really territorial, in so much as they can scare off almost any other bird. So they've just, in the last couple of weeks, they've just started prospecting. You can see here they're setting up on the island in front of us.
And this is quite interesting as a landscape, because, as you say, we've got that small little island in the middle of some flat, obviously, marshland, we could call it. You've got mud, we've got luscious grass yet again around us, but we've also got pylons, electricity pylons, going far into the distance. And if you look over to the left, you can see a few houses. So it's a real mix of urban and nature.
Absolutely, it really is. And I think what's quite unusual with Steeart Marshes is that we've got three villages right on the periphery, all of which have seen sort of the changes that were undertaken sort of 10 years ago, but are also being protected by the new flood banks that have been put in. And they use this very much as a resource. So we get children cycling to school on their bikes, we get local people walking their dogs a couple of times daily. So it's been really embraced by the local community, which is lovely.
So how many bird species do you have here?
We've had up to 53 different species. And in the winter, we've had over 30,000 wintering birds. So it's really been delivering in what it was supposed to in terms of habitat creation.
And what are the more unusual birds that you get here?
The avocet themselves, they weren't breeding in Somerset for 150 years until the scheme arrived. And now we had over 40 pairs last year. We get spoonbills regularly in Otterhampton Marshes, and I love a spoonbill.
Me too. As one of the few, I can actually recognise a spoonbill.
Myself too. Absolutely, absolutely. The skylark, which you can just about pick up in the background, I think we forget how numbers have declined, and we've had over 60 breeding pairs, and that's on the floodbank, so you can see that the floodbank is natural, it's green, it's grass, it's managed as a hay meadow by the farmers.
And it's only a couple of metres above the mud and the... What would you call this area of water?
Saline lagoon.
Let's walk through into the hide, through another sort of cloud of insects. How big is the site?
The entire site is 488 hectares. So it's one of the largest managed realignment schemes in Europe. The really unique thing with Steert is we do have the salt marsh, and that was why this whole scheme is here, as a habitat creation scheme. But we have a brackish area and we have a freshwater area. So we've got three main areas of wetland habitat, and the more people that have come to see Steert who are about to take on their own managed realignment schemes, we realise that that's quite unique. But actually, as you can see as well, the benefits you get from having those three different habitats is right in front of you.
And there are other species here as well, apart from the bird life.
This area in front of us is really important for eels. So we get glass eels in here. So they're coming fresh from the Sargasso Sea, straight out of the system and into the wider landscape. And the reserve itself supports eels at every life stage.
And what about the plant life? I'm a big wildflower fan and was very excited when, as soon as we got here, I saw a marsh marigold, because they're such beautiful, golden, gorgeous flowers. And these are not flowers I see anywhere near my home.
They are stunning, aren't they? And the colour is almost like you just can't recreate it, can you? So the biodiversity of the plant life, that's been increasing year on year. So the hedgerows have developed. We've got really lovely sort of native mixture of hedgerow plants. We've got the salt marsh plants themselves. So we've got 17 sort of salt marsh species that you'd expect in this area, including things like your sea lavender, which is quite a rare one for managed
realignment. Oh, I don't think I've seen sea lavender.
It's beautiful. Sea aster as well, which just like gives you this amazing smell of honey in the air. And then on our wildflower sort of meadows, because we've sort of changed the management and it's less intensive, we've seen them becoming more and more diverse. We get grass vetchling. It's an amazing sort of bright pink. And yeah, we're just seeing with the sort of managing it as a hay meadow, it's just getting more and more diverse, which is fantastic.
So it's an incredible resource, not just for species, but for other benefits, which is obviously the reason that I'm here.
Steert Marshes is a fantastic demonstration site of what wetlands can provide for people. So it's improving water quality as the fresh water moves through the system. The salt marsh itself stores huge amounts of carbon. It acts as a buffer against the tide, so it protects the flood bank itself. We've got the agriculture on site, so we have salt marsh lamb and salt marsh beef produced on site. So there's a really strong agricultural sort of management practices going on here, but less intensive than were here before. Improvement of air quality. Even our freshwater marsh stores additional flood water during high periods of where you've got lots and lots of rain. It always seems to tie in with being high tides when the system gets tide locked. So we're actually able to divert flood water through the reserve to make sure that the flood alleviation ditches don't get overwhelmed. So all sorts of benefits to the local community and the surrounding farmland.
And particularly in terms of the effects of climate change then as well.
Oh, amazing with climate change. If you think about the amount of carbon that's being stored, wetlands are particularly fantastic at storing carbon because they remain wet and they don't release that carbon. And we know here at Steert Marshes the amount of sediment that's built up, sort of, we know up to 2020 there's been over like 900,000 cubic meters of sediment alone that locks in the carbon and it holds on to it. So you think about how that works with climate regulation and nutrient cycling as well, which is obviously vital for life itself.
Thanks go to Alice Laver from WWT for showing me around Steert salt marshes. I bet you wish you'd come along now, Alice, don't you?
I do. I was awfully jealous hearing all of those avocets and the other birds in the background. And I think the thing I was most struck by was the amount of change they've achieved in just 10 years, the amount of biodiversity and the mosaic of sound. You'd think it had been there for a lot longer.
And it fitted very well in the fact that you could see some housing in the distance. You do have those pylons with you, but then you have this beautiful, beautiful area of countryside. So it felt like a fix, I suppose you could say. It felt like a really good fix of nature to use something that's naturally there, which has got so many important properties across so many different areas. And yeah, you couldn't tell that it had been farmland at all 10 years ago, not at all. And it was a lovely day. So win-win.
Much nicer than a couple of episodes ago when you were stuck on a peatland in the pouring rain.
I think it took 3 weeks for my fingers to recover from that. It was so cold. And we will be returning to the Steert salt marshes a little later on in this episode to learn just how you go about recreating these amazing tidal habitats.
I'm really looking forward to listening to that. Now, we heard Alice from WWT refer to the ability of salt marshes to help mitigate climate change by storing carbon, to help us understand just how much the UK salt marsh contributes to the UK's efforts to reduce our greenhouse gases. We spoke to Dr. Annette Burden, a wetland biogeochemist and expert in salt marshes at UKCEH. Welcome to the podcast, Annette. We just heard Sue's visit to Steert, and we're going to hear more later about how they went about restoring the marsh there. We know that we only have 450 square kilometres of salt marsh currently, and that's a much smaller number than we have naturally. But it is a great example of what can be achieved to claw back some of the lost UK salt marsh habitat, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great example of restoration in the UK. The Steert Marshes is one of the largest restoration projects we've had so far. And it's produced some lovely habitat that will keep changing over the years. And these are like beautiful places to be. Salt marshes are lovely, especially at kind of when the sun's going down and you have birds flying over them and everything's in flower. They are beautiful places, and producing more of them through restoration has only got to be a good thing.
And why do you think there has been renewed and increased interest in restoring and replacing some of these lost habitats, and obviously particularly salt marshes?
They provide many like benefits, what we call ecosystem services. So things like food provision, they're used as nursery grounds, flood and coastal protection, and all the recreation and well-being aspects of these places. As I said, they are great places to be, and who doesn't feel better when they've had a walk by the coast? But a lot of these benefits we know more about now than we used to. There's been a lot more research into them. So things like capturing carbon, the existing salt marsh in the UK accumulates around 700,000 tonnes of CO2 within a year. So that can help towards climate change mitigation and things like that. And these are kind of figures that we didn't really know before. And globally, there's been more and more research going on. So I think that has added to our kind of reasons for restoring them, not just for their kind of intrinsic value, but for everything they can provide to society as well.
Some of those numbers that you mentioned are estimates and potential for mitigation. So I'm sort of sensing a few caveats there. How much do we know about how effective these blue carbon stores could be?
Well, we know a lot, but we need to know more. There is such variability around the UK coastline that the carbon benefits will be very different between, say, the east and west coast or north and south. And we don't really have a handle on that variability yet and why there is that variability. So accumulation rates at the moment are, we say, between about 3 and 14 tonnes of CO2 per hectare per year, which is a big range. But with increased research, we'll be able to narrow that down or be able to predict that around the country a bit better. There is a lot of primary research going on in the UK at the moment. So lots of research to try and estimate this benefit in different sites and around the country. And also things like we have a flux tower network now out on salt marshes in the UK. And this is to estimate greenhouse gas emissions, which is one of the parts that we don't really know much about for salt marsh. A lot of what we know is about carbon within the soil. So kind of adding to knowledge of these different carbon pathways will help us to estimate better and then reduce that variability.
And what exactly is a flux tower?
It kind of looks a bit like a weather station.
Not too big then, a metre or so high? Or
yeah, well, the ones on salt marshes do tend to be bigger because we have to keep everything out of the tidal water. So they are taller, as opposed to, say, in peatlands, they're kind of just on a small tripod. But they have sensors on them to measure gases within wind turbulence. So they can measure what's being taken up by the plants, but also what's being released. And then you get a net benefit of that gas between those two. And they can measure carbon dioxide and they can also measure methane. So the ones we have on salt marshes, we're measuring from restored sites and from nearby natural sites as well. So you can get that balance between the two. And we're also looking at the different parts of the UK, so east versus west coast, for example.
You mentioned greenhouse gases there. We've already talked on the podcast about the UK's net zero ambitions. Does the restoration of salt marshes count towards the government's net zero measurements and net zero ambitions?
It doesn't at the moment, but we are doing some work for government to look at how salt marshes would be included in the greenhouse gas inventory, which is our national reporting under the Kyoto Protocol. Under the Land Use Change and Forestry section, the salt marshes could be included. Peatlands were included recently, so there is an example of a wetland within the inventory now. And we are doing some work to look at a roadmap for how we would include salt marsh into the inventory, what kind of data we would need, what we would need to do to track change over time to allow it to be incorporated into the greenhouse gas reporting. Also, the work we're doing on flux towers that I've already mentioned, that will provide data that could be used within the inventory as well. And then other work we're doing, looking at different fluxes in salt marshes, kind of area of salt marshes, how you look at change over time, things like that, will all help towards that goal of salt marshes going into the inventory.
Do we know whether restored or recently restored salt marshes absorb the same amount of carbon at the same rate as longer established salt marshes? I sort of wanted to know whether that benefit is immediate effectively.
It is immediate. The restored salt marshes tend to accumulate a lot of carbon to begin with because they tend to have a lot more space because they're lower in the tidal frame. However, there are nuances on how much of that you can count towards a kind of net zero goal, because some of that carbon will have been in the system already. It's not necessarily because of what you've done, because of your management. But the restored salt marshes do tend to accumulate a lot more, especially in the first few years after restoration. And then they tend to drop down to kind of a baseline level, very similar to a natural marsh. So we know more about natural marshes than restored marshes, but we do know that restored marshes do kind of get to the same point as natural ones in terms of carbon content and storage.
And it's not just the government who's got an interest in restoration of salt marshes, is it?
No. So we are developing the salt marsh code to be part of the voluntary carbon market. So this is where organisations or corporates can buy carbon credits to voluntarily offset their carbon emissions. So it's separate to kind of government reporting, like the greenhouse gas inventory, and it is within the totally voluntary market. But developing a scheme and developing a code means that we can provide that kind of financial pipeline of private investment into restoration projects as well, to hopefully accelerate the amount of salt marsh restoration we can do in the UK.
And you're working on this code with other organisations, aren't you?
Yeah, so it's a consortium across charities like WWT and the finance and academic sectors. We've been working together since about 2021 on the code through various projects. And we hope to have a pilot code ready by summer 25 for projects to start using.
So if there is no salt marsh code for trading those credits currently, where are we getting the funding from for the restoration work that you've already described? Where is this restoration coming from?
A lot of it is for compensatory habitat. So it's for salt marsh that's been lost due to say, sea level rise or erosion, and a lot to do with development. However, we would like to see more. There's a push for more restoration, but we need private finance for that. The public purse wouldn't be able to pay for all of the restoration that we would like to do in the UK. There's a recent government report that shows that 22,000 hectares of salt marsh could be restored in the UK. It's areas that are at risk due to climate change already, but it's very costly. So having more income streams will really help to accelerate that restoration.
Thanks to Annette Burden there for explaining the efforts going on to count the carbon stored in salt marshes towards the UK's inventory for greenhouse gas mitigation, and to get a voluntary code up and running to trade in credits, and so hopefully pave the way for even more restoration. I think the importance of where that funding comes from really surprised me. I hadn't really thought about the scale of finances needed to do a lot of this restoration work, and it really does need to come from multiple sources.
I think for me, the big learning point I've been getting from going was the crucial role they do play in storing carbon. And for me, it's like, well, why aren't we recreating and rebuilding these everywhere? It's quite incredible. I'm sort of slightly blown away by it all, because it's not just their carbon value, you know, this not quite sea, not quite land, but it's the nature that, you know, you referred to the avocets earlier, you know, fighting for nesting space. You've got skylarks in the background and those tidal creeks that are sheltering eels. It's quite exceptional. And those eels are a critically endangered species. And Steert is a great example of what can be achieved in a relatively short period of time. So let's return to that salt marsh to get an understanding of how WWT Steert went about that mammoth task of re-wetting those lands. Right, we've come to another part of the salt marsh. We've got a big pylon right beside us, buzzing with electricity there. But what an amazing view. I mean, it's absolutely stunning. Is that the estuary that's bigger, or is that still just a bit? It almost looks like an estuary.
It's still the River Parret, but because we are right at the mouth of the River Parret where it meets the Bristol Channel, that's why you get this huge expanse. And it's probably one of the best views on the whole reserve, I'd say.
Absolutely lovely. And you've got slightly flooded marshland here in front of us with tufts of grass and fences and another hide. And it's so luscious, isn't it? The colour. I didn't expect it to be so green.
I don't think a lot of people do, actually. Yeah. And I think, because, I mean, we've obviously, like everyone else, we've had a lot of rain. But with the salt marsh, that's all new salt marsh, that expanse in front of us.
Yes. Let's go to the open bit of the hide, otherwise it will sound like we're in a sort of broom cupboard if we go inside that echoey. And it's such a beautiful day, we should really be outside anyway. How do you go about restoring something as big as this? Maybe give me an idea of what it looked like then compared to now.
What this looked like in front of us, you know, you can see this huge expanse of salt marsh. This was about 50 different fields, so all different field parcels, each with a ditch and a hedge around the outside of it. So it was your typical sort of Somerset Levels and Moors landscape. So first and foremost, you know, you have to think of the species that are in those ditches and those hedgerows. They have to be either moved on or mitigated for. You have to fill in the ditches, remove the hedgerows. So it's a huge construction project. The whole thing actually started in 2009. So it's a really, really long process from consultation to when we first cut the breach in terms of landscape works and working with the local community.
And what do you mean by cut the breach?
So you can see on the right-hand side, we've got the old flood wall, which is much lower than the one that we're standing on. So just sort of about 3 kilometres from where we're standing, we actually cut a hole in the old seawall that joined up to the sort of creek system within the main marsh. So that really famous sort of leaf pattern of Steert marshes in the main marsh. And that enabled all the flood water to then come through the hole in the wall, feed through along the creek system, and then start creating this new salt marsh habitat in front of us.
So you effectively flooded what used to be flooded, but was no longer
flooded because it was being used for arable land and farming.
Yeah, it was a mixture of quite intensively farmland and, you know, like many salt marshes, it had been reclaimed for farming, and the whole peninsula's got a history of reclamation and then being flooded again. And then we've got some amazing archaeological finds from old Roman flood walls, medieval farmsteads. We are really putting back what was here, what we took from the estuary in the first place.
And in terms of the farmers that were displaced and houses, was the general reaction that they understood that this was the right thing to do? Because I'm assuming that this area would flood on a regular basis anyway.
Yes. So the most recent flood where that farmland was flooded was in 1981. And so it was in living memory of a lot of the local communities. And there was a real risk of tidal flooding from the River Parret. And so on the back of the habitat creation scheme, where we set back the flood defences, you know, your managed realignment, you're realigning the coastline, you're able to make those flood defences higher as well. So there was an understanding that with climate change, rising sea levels, those sorts of flooding events were going to increase. The farmland would have gone down in value and the properties would have been risk of flooding. So this is a real benefit for the local community. But of course, it was really important to have an open discussion and a consultation process right from day one. And we've got a really good relationship with them now.
So who paid for it then?
It's an Environment Agency scheme. So the Environment Agency paid for it. It's £20.7 million. So they don't come cheap. But £7 million of that was land acquisition. And this is money that was ring-fenced for habitat compensation. It's to do with rising sea levels, climate change and coastal squeeze. So habitat losses, particularly the upper salt marsh, your Atlantic salt marsh, that we know is being lost all around the Severn Estuary, where you've got man-made sea defences that are protecting businesses and homes. The Environment Agency needed to find an area that was large enough to compensate for those losses.
In terms of carbon storage, what is it about salt marshes that allows it to store carbon?
Well, salt marshes are particularly good at storing carbon, and that is because of all the sediment that comes in. So Stiart marshes alone, up until 2020, we know that we've had over 900,000 cubic metres of sediment have accumulated on Stiart marshes, which equates to a huge amount of carbon. The reason that they're particularly good at storing carbon is because they remain wet, so the tide comes in, you've got less microbial activity, so you've got less release of gases, and so it holds onto the carbon in the sediment. But then the salt marsh plants themselves, which store carbon from photosynthesis, they get buried by that sediment and that also gets locked in. So they're absolutely fantastic for storing carbon and then holding on to it.
And this so-called blue carbon, because it involves water effectively, which is a lovely description and a good way to remember the difference, really. You gave a massive figure there in terms of how much sediment is here. Do you have any idea of how much carbon a smaller area of salt marsh can store?
We know Stiart was storing 19 tonnes of carbon per hectare. So that huge figure that I mentioned, that's over 26,000 tonnes of carbon. That equates to sort of 15 trillion mobile phones being charged, or 15,000 homes, the energy that that might use in a year.
I mean, these figures are incredible, and it does make me quite shocked that there are so few salt marshes left in the UK when they are this important. And when you put them in terms of that, in terms of the carbon they can store.
Absolutely. And I think this is the message that we're really trying to get out there. There is a struggle with salt marsh because it's maybe not as obviously doing the job that we're talking about. And some people don't like it when you put nature into monetary values. But if you want people to start taking notice and making changes in policy and recognising the value, not just for, you know, human beings, but for the economy, but also for climate change, building in resilience for the future, you need to talk those figures. But you need the robust science to back it up as well, of course.
And in the same way that peatlands is now considered an important player, effectively, as a sort of, you know, carbon offset, salt marshes are not considered in the same division, really, are they?
No, unfortunately not. And again, that's something that, you know, what I love about WWT is that we work with lots of different research bodies. So all the data that's being collected here, you know, we've got the amount of sedimentation, we've measured the carbon flux, we're now looking at the salt marsh plants and how the diversity of the salt marsh can affect how much carbon is stored. We're trying to get all of that and really nail down on the science. We'll then hopefully get a salt marsh code written, so it's then seen as sort of part of that infrastructure that needs to go ahead to reach our targets for net zero.
Could Stiart then become a sort of role model for other parts of the UK to introduce salt marshes or restore salt marshes, particularly when we've only got 15% of natural salt marshes compared to 150 years ago?
Absolutely. And I mean, that's why WWT took on Stiart Marshes as a demonstration of what wetlands do for people and wildlife, but also in terms of design and what can be done on sort of a landscape scale. So that's something that we're really pushing for. And we get a lot of people looking at sort of the design process, the construction process, and we're seen sort of as leading experts in that field now. And it's really important to share that knowledge, best practice, knowledge exchange. And we're doing work all over the UK to try and find the best ways of finding the sites where you have those salt marshes, areas of risk. There's loads of different factors to take on board when doing something on this sort of scale. But yeah, we very much see Stiart, now that it's 10 years old, is a brilliant example of what it can look like in of quite a short amount of time and with all those extra benefit that we've discussed.
Site manager Alice Laver.
It really emphasised that these habitats can coexist. You can have a beautiful salt marsh that is there for the local community alongside houses, pylons and these other things.
Yes, and what's quite nice about it as well is that during COVID, like many nature places, having green space, and in this case, green and blue space, because there's so much water as well, proved to have a huge natural positive effect on people's well-being, so much so that they actually got funding for a well-being officer during the pandemic. But they're also taking that further because it is having such a positive benefit on people's mental health. As we know, being out in nature calms people down while at the same time having these huge, enormously positive effects on carbon and storage. And I won't forget blue carbon now either. I love that phrase. Blue for water, green for green leaves. I don't know why I didn't get it first time.
And the potential of the salt marsh carbon code is quite large. It really could increase funding for restoration, and that would increase the access that people would have to these spaces and lead to more habitats like WWT Stiart being created, which would not only bring carbon benefits, but help with so much more, like flood mitigation that we know is really important. And it would help us to build on the 450 square kilometres of natural salt marsh that we were left with.
And it's a shame that salt marshes don't get the same public recognition as rainforests or woodlands. But hopefully that will change soon. I think what's become clear after visiting those salt marshes is that wetlands are a vital tool in our fight against climate change, and also an extremely beautiful and restful one too.
Join us next time on Counting the Earth when we take another look at nature through numbers. Thank you for listening.